Okay, take it away, Kimu.
Hey, thank you. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Village Zendo office in Santa Fe. Station, thank you, and thank all of you for being present, even if we are scattered through space and time. I'd like to tell you a story about the power of words, a topic that I spend quite a lot of time thinking about. It's also a very personal encounter with some of the pitfalls of language in my own life. There are lots of stories, as you know, in Zen about how words can become walls and suggestion can lead to suffering. Words really get a pretty bad rap in Zen, and well, they should at least one level. But I was recently reminded quite forcefully that words are both a cause of suffering and a tool to end it. About 6 weeks ago, I went to the hospital for a routine test to confirm whether I had a condition called acid reflux and whether I needed minor surgery to correct it. At the end of a half-hour appointment, I left in an utter daze. The surgeon, hearing my gravelly voice, had asked if I were a smoker, which I never have been. And when I said no, he started, without further ado, to lecture me on throat cancer, implying that both I and my primary care physician had been idiots not to consult him long before. Surgeons are known for that, I guess, but it was quite a shock. Reflux, he said, as part of his lecture, was second only to smoking as a cause of cancer, which itself is the second most frequent cause of death in the US. And his only recommendation was an exploratory procedure and that I should lose weight. Now, some of you may be thinking, oh boy, we're going to have a pity party for the next 30 minutes. Or you may be dreading what people my age and older call the organ recital, a laundry list of aches, pains, injustices, and ailments. Please don't leave yet. That's not at all my intent. The tale I'm about to tell you should really be presented by a stand-up comic. It's a comedy of error, my error, or in more Buddhist terms, a comedy of delusion. Trying to follow your own mind, as you know, and also the language that your mind uses to justify itself, is inherently funny. And I don't mind being the butt of my own joke. But I'm not a comedian, and neither am I standing up. So you'll have to provide your own humor. It took several hours for the surgeon's lecture to sink in and convince me that I was a dead man walking. I'm serious, not being a comedian. In the meantime, I managed to suppress the bad news and attend a party for Fat Tuesday, which, as you may know, is a pre-Lent celebration for leaving behind the pleasures of the flesh. The irony didn't strike me until later. By the next morning, sleep had dismantled my defenses, and I woke up terrified. Death had become an imminent fact for the first time in my life. Now, oddly, I wasn't worried about death per se. I was terminally upset about being cheated of the time that I'd counted on to finish all the projects I have going. And I mean freaked out. So I lay in bed, moaned, groaned, raged, and eventually cried myself out, which is a state not too different from the after effects of intensive Zazen. Both are embodied conditions in which the mind relaxes into silence and the body can make itself heard. Lucky for me. From a Zen perspective, the shock of confronting the great matter not only concentrates the mind, but shuts off its worst habits. Physically exhausted, I really had no further energy for worry and speculation. Did the doctor see some telltale symptom and refuse to tell me? Why would he have lectured me about cancer unless he knew I was doomed? Did the receptionist know too? She seemed awfully eager to find me a quick appointment for follow-up. Was waiting a week going to be fatal? My body told me in no uncertain terms that these were irrelevancies. Now, the first bit of body wisdom was a little startling. "You're fat," said my body. Okay, granted, I did gain the infamous pandemic 20 pounds and seemed to be continuing in that unwanted direction. But what's body shaming got to do with it? I thought. I soon won't have one to be ashamed of. But the wise body had a different point to make. If you were really sick with cancer, you wouldn't be gaining weight. As I started to check in with my body, I was struck by the fact that I didn't feel as sick as esophageal cancer ought to make me. Maybe I was fooling myself, but I felt uncomfortable, not deathly ill. The voice in which this awareness presented itself was completely neutral in tone. And that's something I've learned to use as a distinction between genuine intuitive knowing and plain old worries. For me, intuitions are calm, neither good nor bad. Worries are always attached to, oh my God, damn it, why me, blah, blah, blah. The gut certainty that I was doomed was couched in intense and entirely negative emotions. The logic of that, that the fears were likely unfounded, took a while to dawn on me. Now, you probably recognize what I couldn't at first, that the words and stories I was telling myself were causing my suffering. Based on the words of an expert, which were plausible, I was completely convinced I was going to die. I made the classic mistake, too, of doom scrolling through websites about cancer. They told me that if you detect this kind of cancer soon enough and before it spreads, you have a 50-50 chance of living for 5 years afterwards. Pretty discouraging statistic. But I realized it was only a statistic, and in Zen terms, only some words. So I began recalling what I've learned about words from Zen practice. Interestingly enough, it was my body awareness that was pushing me to consider how words work. From the standpoint of body awareness, the words of the surgeon and the several thousand I'd heaped on top of those were insubstantial as steam from a boiling pot. Don't get me wrong, words are wonderful things to use once you master them. They and any other type of symbol, like images or numbers, seem to me to be markers that represent pieces of the world. And their main use seems to me, again, to be when we want to consider what-if situations. So rather than having to erect a building and wait 5 years to see whether it falls down, we can what-if with drawings and numbers that stand in for physical beams and posts and test its performance in a simulation. But that simulation doesn't really have reality value. It's what-if, and it excludes many possibilities. Similarly, we can say to ourselves, what if I say thus and such to my boss? Am I more likely to be praised or be in deep doo-doo? You don't try this out on your boss, you try it out on your word symbol of your boss in your head, which is much safer. And that is a big part of the nature of words. By using words as imaginary markers, we save ourselves literally having to do the tests. This is the basis of a lot of planning and science, but it has huge pitfalls, particularly the risk of attaching to words as if they were facts. Guilty as charged. To be able to what if about things that involve me, it's necessary to adopt a placeholder for my person, a cardboard cutout by the name of I. To me, I is analogous to zero in Arabic numbers, a symbol that in itself means nothing, yet by its place in context with other numbers, makes a difference between 1,000 and 1,000,000. Unfortunately, I, instead of being a zero, often turns into a fixed thing that the person is ruled by rather than vice versa. Some of you may know the wonderful 1950s comic strip called Pogo, which took on McCarthyism with sharp satire and gorgeous drawings. Pogo the Opossum, the main character, was an everyman, and in one strip, he was shown imagining things in thought bubbles, a symbol, a standard symbol in cartooning. Eventually, he imagined an alligator, which grew until it burst out of the bubble and chased Pogo across the page. And one of his companions comments, "Shouldn't have thunk such a big one." If we believe our thought bubbles too literally, they tend to produce magical thinking, stuckness, arrogance, and suffering. They just don't work quite like the reality they're supposed to represent. Consider these scenarios. If I write 2 dozen eggs on a list, I don't automatically have 24 eggs. In fact, putting the number on the list usually indicates that you don't have the eggs. And some things that we can imagine are difficult or impossible to actualize. It's easy to figure out in numbers that half of a recipe that calls for 7 eggs will be 3.5 eggs. It's much more difficult to actually produce a half egg. These are just a couple of examples of twisted ways of thinking that we do all the time, something Zen warns us against, and exactly what I was doing about my alleged analysis or diagnosis. I've been a worrywart since I was about 4. Maybe I was born that way. My brain's always on the lookout for danger. Neurobiologists say that this is an evolutionary trait in all of us that makes us filter out harmless input and accentuate any perceived threat. So I was rather surprised at what happened next. I made a mental list of all the surgeon's assertions and asked myself what evidence there was for each of them. The answer was not much. I looked at each assertion as a wandering thought, a product of monkey mind rather than a logically proven reality. And I recalled how every perception and every word that conveys perceptions is partially invisible. We see the front side, but not the back. And we also fail to see ourselves seeing, to watch ourselves using words and names for things. I'm not actually sure how I was able to recall these downsides of verbal thought in the midst of my self-induced panic. But as a result, I said to myself, I refuse to spend the next several weeks of my life being terrorized by unsubstantiated opinions. Those weeks may be the last days of my life, or the test may come back negative, which means positive. In either case, I'm not going to allow those words to intrude on my existence until and unless they're backed up some way. And to my very great surprise, I was actually able to dispel my fear by recalling what I knew about the nature of words. It seems a very intellectual way of doing so, but it worked for me. And for me, at least, it came straight out of Zen teaching. A month later came the hardest part. I got the actual test results and found them so full of jargon that I couldn't be clear whether I was okay or not. I started hearing echoes in my mind of the 5 stages of grieving, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. I'll eat all my lima beans forever if you make it not cancerous. I finally had to ask the doctor twice for a clear, simple summary of the results. And here's the joke, it turned out to be nothing at all. A few days later, the universe sent me another situation for comparison. I have a small wart on the back of one hand. It got swollen, so I went to see an urgent care doctor. He said very calmly, it might be a wart, but could also be something called squamous cell carcinoma. And before you worry, he said, there's only a 10% chance of such things being cancerous and a 10% chance of those cancerous ones being fatal. So you have a 99% chance of it being perfectly treatable. It needs specialist attention, but nothing too urgent. This was right speech manifested where it could do the most good. This man's summary, compared to the unskillfulness of the surgeon, left me feeling clear, hopeful, and seen. He didn't try to hide the potential problem from me, but gave me clear and straightforward estimates of how important it was likely to be. And he was comfortable with not knowing. The surgeon seemed to have to know everything. And the urgent care doc was quite intimate with my fears and concerns without my having to explain them. Words matter. In this case, the difference between the two doctors triggered totally different reactions in me, one of which was, for a short while, serious suffering, and the other one was immediate relief. But there is, even among practitioners of Zen, widespread misinterpretation of slogans like, he who speaks does not know, or beyond words and phrases. These are classic and very valuable teachings, but they often lead people to be completely negative about words. I was surprised by how potent a remedy for terror and worry words could actually be. And hard on the heels of that lesson, I was reminded how compassionate and supportive words can be. I was, of course, lucky. My brush with cancer turned out to be a self-inflicted rumor. I don't know whether I'd be able to use the same lessons if someday another surgeon gives me unequivocally hard and harsh news. Some of you may well have been in that position, and I hope I haven't in any way diminished that challenge, which I evaded for the time being. But what I confronted was my own self-injury through words. I'd like to finish with a quote from a book by Victor Sogen Hori. It's called Zen Sand, published by the University of Hawaii. It's a kind of dictionary of expressions used in koans and other Zen speech. That isn't a topic of interest to everybody by any means, but I highly recommend Hori's introductory essay. It's as clear and succinct an exposition as I've seen of Zen's love-hate relationship with words. Zen practice, he says, is not a breaking out of language into a realm of silence, but a sophisticated use of language to express and realize awakening. Zen seeks not freedom from language by rejecting it, but freedom in language by mastering it. I hope these words may be of value. Thank you very much.